on ABC Radio New South Wales. This is the Country Hour.
And I'm Michael Condon. On the program today, new ideas on how to tackle rising rates of rural suicide and a report into farm fatalities in New South Wales has found there's been no improvement in work-related death rates.
We do note that the rates in the last 15 years have stagnated, and that is really of serious concern because I think, as Albert Einstein said, insanity is if you keep doing the same thing, you'll get the same results. But the known causes very closely replicated what we found nationally as well, with tractors and quads the two leading causes.
You might have some views on that. Tractors and quads the main causes. 0467 922 684, and we'll look at the issue of suicide as well. 0467 922 684 is a number to text us here at the Country Hour. So all that and a whole lot more coming up on the program. But first to suicide, there's a new push to tackle rural suicide. It's been unveiled today by the Centre for Rural and Remote Mental Health. While national suicide rates are falling overall, the rates are climbing in the bush, with rates up to 50% higher. Professor David Perkins says a new study has found that getting the local community involved in caring for people is one strategy that appears to be working. He says that a one-size-fits-all approach to suicide doesn't apply to rural and regional Australia.
Yeah, the rural figures are getting worse, but it's at the time when the aggregate national figure has got a little bit better. And the difference between the capital cities and the rural and remote is about 50%. So it's 50% higher if you live in rural, remote or very remote Australia. And if you live in very remote Australia, it's even higher than. So, you know, it gets worse as you get more remote.
So you're saying, why isn't this a national tragedy or being dealt with on a national basis?
Exactly. We're saying that the assumption that a recipe that works in the city will actually work in rural and remote areas is not the case. And people haven't been thinking that rural and remote is different. It's got different resources. It's got different industries. It's got dispersed populations, it's got a different age structure, it's got different services, it's just different.
And it's got different stressors of life and the farming life or rural and remote life, so that has to come into play as well.
Yeah, we think about farmers, and farmers face fire, flood, drought, economics, the whole thing. But we also need to think about people who work in, let's say, mining. And, you know, if that's the only job in your city or your town, and someone overseas who owns the mine decides to move on or decides you're not making enough money or the prices have gone down, you lose your job. So you don't have the choices you have in Sydney or in Melbourne where, you know, you can stay in the same house and work for 10 different employers over 20 years. Just not like that.
And also then the added stress of fly in, fly out, and alcohol abuse and loneliness and those things that take a toll on miners as well.
Yeah, I think loneliness is a particular one. Loneliness, often these are, you know, young guys, they're separated from their partners, they're separated from their kids. They don't see the milestones, the birthdays, you know, things don't quite. And yeah, and it's a very, it's good while you're in work, but you can be out of work very rapidly.
Now, also the other issue I wanted to touch on is you've actually been talking to the politicians, you've been trying to get them interested in these issues. What are they saying?
Well, essentially, I think they're keen to do something, but they're not quite sure what to do. And one of the things we've tried to do in this document is to say, what is it we should do? And we've always focused on people who are suicidal, who are thinking they might take their own lives. But that's a little bit like, and I'm not trying to be disrespectful here, that's a little bit like trying to find a needle in a haystack. It's a rare event. And the assumption that, A, we can find people who are suicidal in time, and B, that we can change their minds, change their track, is challenging. So we're saying we've got to think about what we do immediately. That's looking after people and asking people, you know, you're not thinking of doing anything, you're not thinking of self-harming, are you? So asking those questions, are you okay, is fantastic along those lines.
But they're hard questions often, and people don't, questions. In our society, they're hard questions for people to ask.
They are hard questions for people to ask, but my centre does a lot of training in rural areas from, you know, an hour and a half to an afternoon to a little bit longer, just encouraging people. Because it's a bit like first aid. You know, if someone has an accident in the street, I did my first aid a long time ago, but I would sort of try and drag up my courage and try and be helpful. You know, we have this sense that if someone has a road accident, you should be helpful. But if someone's clearly distressed, you know, we can't walk by on the other side. So, you know, we have a, and with a little bit of training, with a little bit of reduction of stigma, a little bit more understanding, and, you know, groups like Beyond Blue have done a lot of good in trying to reduce stigma. But if we can reduce, if individuals can be part of the solution, that's great.
The cities are different to the country, the rural and remote areas, where you do like that to have that sort of human contact, that the individuals, the community rallying around people, and not just having something on the computer or not having someone on the phone. Yeah. That seems so impersonal in a bush setting, and people in the bush seem to be sort of distrustful of that too.
Yeah, I think so, and often they just don't have the NBN access to do it anyway. Mm. But someone saying, "Are you okay? How are you? You don't seem too good today," and being concerned about the answer. You know, it's all very well saying, "Hey, you're doing good," but actually being concerned about the answer and then knowing how to be helpful is very much part of the solution.
And this is a role that communities can, you know, that people can have in libraries, in land care groups,
yeah,
they can have in local councils. So it's, I guess you're calling for more training of people. People that may have some experience of this in the past, or maybe just they have a general interest?
Just someone who can, you know, grab up a little bit of Dutch courage and actually say to their workmate or to someone in school or to their neighbour, "How are you? Mm. How are you going?" And, you know, who is willing to give a little bit of time, because people don't immediately say, "I'm thinking of harming myself."
But you're also thinking about some formal training as well, this sort of gatekeeper thing you've talked about before. So there's a formal training component for those people that are on the front line in certain areas.
Yeah, we think almost anyone can do some gatekeeper training if they're, you know, serious about trying to be of help, serious about trying to help their neighbour or someone in their school or someone in their workplace or whoever it might be. We think that gatekeeper training is part of the solution. I mean, we think we have to broaden the focus, though, you know, because it's all very well trying to pick people who may end their lives by suicide, but that's a very hard thing to do. We think we've got to look after the group of people who have lost someone by suicide. You know, how do we look after the parents? How do we look after the schoolmates? How do we look after the workmates? How do we look after someone on the farm, whoever it might be? And, you know, that's about, you know, having the courage not to stop talking about the person, not to, you know, not bring up the topic of conversation. We think that people in public services, you know, need to actively go and visit. You know, if you've lost someone by suicide, you know, the hardest thing might be to turn up at the doctor's or to turn up somewhere else. We think maybe someone should turn up and say, "How are you going?"
And an early warning system before it gets to the stage where people are exhibiting signs of mental illness. They may be exhibiting signs of depression. So
yeah,
an early warning system.
We think we've got to go upstream. Mm. So we think we've got to look at vulnerable groups in communities. We've got to work out who those vulnerable groups are. They might be people who are isolated. They might be people.
And I would imagine in towns around Australia now, there are people in those communities and they know, "Oh, yeah, I think that person is at risk."
Yeah,
I would know.
And one of the great things is give them a ring. You know, go and knock on the door. If you see them going by, you know, be prepared to be late for something and say to them, you know, "How are you? Would you like a coffee?" We know that isolation is a very serious problem, and that, you know, if we can address that isolation, we can improve people's mental well-being.
And what sort of response have you had in terms of getting the money to do these sorts of programs?
Well, getting the money is always tricky, but we have some money from New South Wales Health. We were given this money over 5 years, which was the last minister, Prue Goward, which was a courageous. And we have rural adversity mental health workers in each part of rural New South Wales. We also have a program called Good Space. And that program is about providing people with training, particularly with respect to suicide. And we have a program called We Yarn, which has been designed with and for Aboriginal people. We obviously see Aboriginal people, farmers, other people as groups who may from time to time be at particular risk. And so we believe we need to identify those groups and be active about trying to help them. Some of the primary health networks have given us money in the north of the state. With more money, we would like to broaden our programs. We also, though, want to work with other people. So, you know, one of our longer-term investments is about children and young people. And one of the issues is about keeping them safe. We all know about the Royal Commission on Abuse. We know about domestic violence. We know about, you know, kids who are going to school without breakfast. We know about rural poverty. So we want to identify those kids and have programs that are appropriate for their particular ages. So that, yeah, and we'll do that with schools in partnership. But we are keen to ensure that rural is just not seen as another odd group. You know, it's 30% of the population by some, you know, demographics. And, you know, it's responsible for primary industries, for a lot of our exports, a lot of the wealth and the character of the country. And we don't think it can just be left as another odd group to be put in as a chapter at the end. We think we've got to focus on rural communities and understand that they're different.
Professor David Perkins from he's a director of the Centre for Rural and Remote Mental Health based in Orange. And if that discussion about suicide has raised some issues with you, you'd like to talk to someone, you can ring Lifeline on 1311 14 or Beyond Blue on 1300 224636. We've had a text in on that issue already. You might want to text in here at the country, 0467 922 684, and they've texted in saying it's tough in farming, too much stress and suicides. A good start would be to stop stealing water from innocent farmers. We need an independent audit of the Murray-Darling operations and its New South Wales government management. 17 minutes past 12. Well, a report into farm fatalities in New South Wales has found there's no improvement in work-related death rates. The data released by the Public Health Research and Practice found the sector's death rates were 12 times the state's all-industry average. Tony Lower from the Australian Centre for Agricultural Health and Safety is one of the report's authors. He spoke about the findings with reporter Kathleen Ferguson.
This study looks at information within New South Wales from 2001 through to 2015. And the key findings really are that there has been no change in the rate of work-related deaths across New South Wales in the whole period. So it's remained static, really at around 17 deaths per 100,000 workers. And that figure within the agricultural sector is 12 times higher than the all-industry rate for New South Wales.
Given it's, you know, over 14 years and nothing's been done to improve those rates, is that something that's being seen as quite negative?
Yes, certainly. And look, I think there is some good news within this story as well. And that good news is that when we look at the rates back in the early 1990s, we're currently looking at a reduction overall from that period of around 30 to 40%. However, we do note that the rates in the last 15 years have stagnated, and that is really of serious concern because I think, as Albert Einstein said, insanity is if you keep doing the same thing, you'll get the same results.
What is the major concern that this could lead to, that just it continues to be, we can't reduce the rates?
Well, I think there's some really key things that we can do to reduce the rates of injuries that are occurring. But unfortunately, what has happened within New South Wales, and we can't clearly demonstrate cause and effect in this instance, is that around the mid-2000s, New South Wales Health in particular dropped injury as a priority from its priority list of actions which it was addressing. And that meant that there were many local safety action groups that had previously been in operation and provided independent information and support to local farmers ceased to exist, and I think currently there's only one of those groups up in the north coast around Casino that's still functional.
Would it be re-establishing this as a priority could be one step towards reducing these rates?
Well, look, I think, again, one of the things that we need to say, obviously a lot of this remit falls with Safe Work New South Wales, and they need to be congratulated for leading the way on some of the issues, particularly around quad bikes and the rebate for safer vehicles and crash protection devices. But at one point, they can't be both the educators and also the enforcers. And typically, producers really are quite suspicious, I suppose, of Safe Work New South Wales, irrespective of the good intentions that they may have. And there is a need for independent information to be available to producers where they can discuss issues with people without the fear of prosecution.
What was, in terms of the data collected, the known causes of serious injuries and fatalities?
The Narran cause has very closely replicated what we found nationally as well, with tractors and quads the two leading causes. But I think one of the things that we did identify for New South Wales, which was quite revealing, is that when you look at the tractor cases, 80% of the tractor cases involve producers over the age of 50 years of age. And similarly, in terms of the quad bike incidents, we find that 65% of the deaths involve farmers over the age of 50 years of age. So there is some work that needs to be done there, and clearly we want to keep our older producers in the game for as long as they can, or as long as they want to be in the game, but we need to find ways to actually ensure that they can continue to work within the industry safely.
Where is this data? Are you hoping will have the most impact? Will it be seeking support of government, of the New South Wales government, or is it going to be given to Safe Work New South Wales? Where is this going to go? How is it going to make changes?
Well, I think one of the issues is that injury prevention really cuts across many different portfolios. So it's not just Safe Work New South Wales. Similarly, it's not just for the health department or the primary industries group. So it does cut across many of the different government portfolios. And we do know that preventing injury is highly cost effective, because within Australia, each death conservatively costs us over $2 million. So it's a very strong return on investment if we can actually reduce these incidents. And what we'd really like to do is encourage the state government to re-engage within injury prevention more broadly, not just within the agricultural sector, but also more broadly in other areas as well, to actually reduce the burden that at the end of the day comes out of taxpayers' pockets.
Tony Lower from the Australian Centre for Agricultural Health and Safety talking to Kathleen Ferguson.
G'day, I'm Martin Murray from Tamworth, and I listen to The Country Hour. I love the show, keep it up.
Well, to wine news now, and as exports to China boom, the big question for winemakers is how to do business there. Wine exports grew 42% in the last 12 months, but Chinese tastes are different, and the business culture is also different. Rob Geddes is a UK-accredited master of wine who produces an annual guide to Australian wine vintages. He's based in Shanghai now, and David Claughton caught up with him on a visit back home and asked him for his top tips on selling wine to China.
Learn how the locals do business. It's rubber on the road before you open your mouth. A lot of research. Shanghai is big enough to take most medium-sized wineries' total production if they get it right. But don't go up there with an Australian attitude. You're doing business in another country. You've got to find out how they do it. You've got to drink endless cups of hot water, because that's the first drink they'll offer you, the hot water or tea. Understanding the cuisines, because China's got eight major cuisines, and between those eight cuisines, Dongbei, which is the Beijing end of it, more meat, basically. And the Sichuan, the southern food, everyone knows it's hot and spicy. Shanghai has the most delicate cuisine of all. So the wines that work are going to come from southern Western Australia and from Victoria and Tasmania to suit that market.
And is it better to go as an individual company to China, try and strike up a deal?
Or? I don't think so. One aspect of a wine boom is gathering of information in certain forms, and the trade show business is enormous up there. Trade shows are where I'd go. I'd take a stand. I would go a week early, meet some people. We're exhibiting at such and such a show. Come and see us. And the trade shows are so different. I just worked with one in Guangzhou, and she said, well, the last time we sold any Australian wine here, he bought $500,000 worth on a single transfer. And that will happen in Guangzhou. But in Shanghai, you're going to find a distributor who's going to have very short hands and very deep pockets. And so you've got to work out how to get paid and how that's going to work. Beijing, they've got a thrust about them. They embody all of the Chinese confidence. And they will look for these richer red wines. And they will want meat-friendly wine that suits their market.
What are some of the success stories for Australian operators in China?
You've got to look at the brand that is the umbrella that the whole of Australia shelters under, and that's Penfolds. The Penfold name translates very favourably in Chinese, and so when they're buying the brand, they're buying goodwill in their own language, and it sets the price for the market of Australian wine. It sets the reputation for Australian wine. And in the boom, the flavour profile is perfect for the market.
And who's, are we seeing that things coming back the other way? Chinese companies buying into Australian vineyards?
Yes, we are. We've seen purchases in nearly every major wine region now, I believe, with another one to be announced this month. I heard over lunch the other day, but he got coy after that. He told me which region, but I'm not going to say.
What are the pros and cons of that, do you think?
I think Australia needs more investment, and so I'm basically expansionist. I believe that Bob Hawke got it right when he said they can't take the land with them, so they can buy, let them buy the winery, because the land's always going to be here. It's not going to go away. I think people have very strong views about that. The Chinese focus on buying Australian wineries is to get the supply cost down as low as possible. And so these wineries start to assume very Chinese mentalities. And sometimes the Australian mentality is much more viable because it understands what we call ladder brands. Going back to Penfolds, you have different names and different prices. And that need to have the ability to get premium product going is really critical up there.
So you would say we shouldn't be scared of Chinese investment in Australia, but mistakes can be made when Chinese companies buy Australian companies.
Yes, there's some pretty sad stories coming out now of wineries in South Australia that were sold, and it took them a long time to understand the way the Chinese think, because they're not really inclined to invest a lot having made the capital purchase. Their way of running a business is quite different. So there's been some conflicts and there's been some sad stories.
Rob Geddes is a wine writer and a master of wine, and he's now based in China. He was talking there with David Claughton. It's 26 minutes past 12. Well, before we head to weather and news headlines, it's official now. We have a La Nina, but it's different from those before. It's weaker, and it means that it's less likely to bring out more rainfall than the normal La Nina system would. Jonathan Pollock is a climatologist with the Bureau of Meteorology and explains just what this sort of La Nina may mean.
That's right. It's official now. The Bureau have made their announcement yesterday, or a declaration, that we are in La Nina, certainly the early parts of La Nina. And so what that means is there's a pattern out in the Pacific where in the sort of the central regions of the ocean, the temperatures, the sea surface temperatures, are almost a degree cooler than usual. And further over in the west of the Pacific, normally during La Nina, we'd have sort of warmer than average waters. And it sort of makes sort of a bit of a horseshoe shape around the western Pacific, and a bit of a sort of a cold tongue, if you like, coming out across the centre, stretching out from South America.
And you'd normally see above average rainfall during a La Nina.
That's right. So generally, if you had that pattern where you had sort of warmer than average waters in the west, sort of around Australia, that would give you sort of more moisture and more cloudiness, which would translate to more rainfall for some of the weather systems that we receive. But what's really interesting this year is that we've got these cool waters out in the central Pacific giving us out of what we technically call a La Nina. But over in the west, we haven't really got that same sort of warm horseshoe pattern that we would normally have. So without those sort of warmer than average waters around northern Australia, we might not get the sort of the typical above average rainfall that we would normally get during a La Nina. So a bit different than usual, perhaps, this La Nina.
Is it fair to say it's kind of a weaker signal than normal?
Well, generally, the Pacific gets organised a bit earlier in the year. It doesn't normally take this long for the sort of the pattern to get bedded down. And so happening so late in the year, and most of the international models are suggesting this pattern's only going to last for a few months. And generally with La Niñas, the strength of their impacts is sort of related to the strength of the event. So this event looks like it's going to be pretty marginal. And as I mentioned before, we don't have those other sort of warm waters around Australia. So that's probably why we've got a pretty neutral outlook for most of the country, pretty close to sort of even odds for above or below average rainfall.
Well, I was just about to ask, I might get you to expand on that a bit. So it is looking more neutral in terms of how much rain might fall.
That's right. At the end of November, the latest set of outlooks for December and for summer, December to February, showed a wet signal, certainly for most of Victoria and a lot of southeast Australia. And really, that was sort of picking up on that the weather pattern, the weather event that we've just had, which was, you know, pretty extraordinary. And we got sort of a, you know, more than our December totals for large parts of Victoria. But really, the rest of the outlook for summer, December to February, is pretty neutral. It's really only in the sort of the east of the state where we've got a signal for wetter than normal conditions. And as I mentioned, that a lot of that's probably to do with that December weather event that's already come through.
Mm. And so what? How strong is the confidence levels around the, I guess, the modelling at the moment? Do you have a strong confidence there?
Well, there's fairly good agreement between all the international models that this event is probably going to last till about the end of summer and then break down.
And then from there, we're yet to see what will happen from there.
That's right. And generally at that time of the year, and that's generally typical for an event to sort of break down then. And generally then there's a bit of chaos in the Pacific before it sort of settles down again for its next cycle.
And what's on the temperature side of things, what's likely to happen in terms of temperatures or likely temperatures?
Mm-hmm. Well, the temperature signal's a bit more sort of emphatic. It's got a bit more direction. It's telling us that it's going to be warm for daytimes and nighttimes for most of Victoria, especially so in the south where the odds are really strong, sort of greater than 80%, that it'll be a warmer than normal sort of summer.
Jonathan Pollock, who's a climatologist with the Bureau of Meteorology. La Nina, it's official. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's 29 minutes to one. Let's find out what's official in the news. Here's Helen Zaremis.
Thanks, Michael. Conservative MPs have been pushing for last-minute changes to same-sex marriage laws, but they're unlikely to succeed. The lower house is on the brink of passing laws to legalise same-sex marriage in Australia. US Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's defended President Donald Trump's decision to recognise Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. The decision to move the US embassy in Israel to Jerusalem has been criticised by other world leaders. The federal government's announced controversial and outspoken former federal Labor politician Gary Johns as the new Charities Commissioner. Labor and a number of organisations have criticised the decision, saying Dr. Johns has been a long-term campaigner against many charities. And Australian researchers say they've achieved a major breakthrough in the treatment of haemophilia, a life-threatening blood disorder. More news at one, Michael.
That'd be interesting. See the situation there. That's been a bugbear for the medical fraternity for hundreds of years.
Yeah, yeah, like a lot of other things.
Oh, that's true too.
Yeah.
All right, Helen, we'll talk to you later.
If you're lucky.
If I'm lucky. I'll see you downstairs later on.
Bye.
Helen Zaremis with the news. Let's find out what's happening with the weather details. And Rob Taggart's here. Good afternoon, Rob.
Good afternoon, Michael.
So, official La Nina, what's that going to mean for New South Wales?
Yeah, listen, I heard snippets of Jonathan's talk there. What it basically means is that we've got odds of slightly in favour of exceeding average rainfall in most of New South Wales. But as Jonathan mentioned, a lot of that was because of the rain event that we've already seen, particularly over the southern parts of New South Wales over the last couple of days. So for the rest of the summer, there's still good odds of exceeding average rainfall in the southeast of the state, but the rest of the state, there's not really a strong signal either here or there. So in the southeastern parts and along central parts of the coast, a reasonable chance of exceeding normal average rainfall conditions, but no real strong signal either way. And in terms of temperatures, so typical summer temperatures across most of New South Wales, the exception being right down near the Victorian border where we're expecting hotter than average conditions.
Right, okay. So, he said that there were some weaker than usual La Nina signals, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. And certainly if you look at some of the big La Ninas that happened in the early part of this decade, associated with the Brisbane floods, for example, I mean, there were several factors in play there, including warmer than average Indian Ocean temperatures, sea surface temperatures. That's not in play this time. So it's not going to be a typical La Nina, and all the models seem to indicate that it's going to be a fairly short-lived one as well.
Right, is that right? Okay. Now, and what about going from looking at the climate and what's going to happen in the future, what about in the next 7 days?
Yeah, so there's a front currently over South Australia and Victoria. That's going to move through Western New South Wales overnight and eastern New South Wales tomorrow. So it's going to bring showers over the southern inland today, and then tomorrow we're looking at showers over eastern districts. Now, the totals aren't that large, but particularly over the northeast tomorrow and also the central eastern districts, there's a good chance of thunderstorms. And there's a range of scenarios with thunderstorms tomorrow. One scenario is that we could see some severe thunderstorms, particularly through the Hunter and the northern slopes and coast.
Okay, and then warming up after that?
Yeah, so the showers will almost clear out of the whole state by Saturday. Only showers and thunderstorms in the far northeast on Saturday, so northern tablelands, ranges and slopes, and then almost no rainfall for the rest of the state from Sunday onwards. But yes, heating up. So the heat is building over the west of the state, in particularly next week. We're expecting 40 degrees in Tibooburra on Tuesday, and those 40 degree temperatures, low 40s, spreading through western districts on Wednesday and Thursday. And we're expecting high 30s to come right through to the coast as well about mid next week.
Okay, so the 40s and then high 30s for a number of parts by the sound of things.
That's right. Yep. So at the moment, there's a signal for a low intensity heat wave at this stage. But closer to the event, we'll see whether that ramps up a little bit or not.
Okay, Rob, thanks for that.
You're welcome.
24 minutes to one on the Country Hour. We had a text in from Anne at Canamble. We're talking about the stresses of farming earlier. And she says the greatest stress to farmers at present, from her point of view, comes from the threat of coal seam gas mining and the betrayal of the government. She says if we lose our water, we'll have to walk off the land. And many farmers are suffering huge stress and breakdowns over this. She knows of suicides that are directly attributed to this. And several farmers at the Canamble meeting yesterday talked about the incredible stress that they're under at the moment. Yeah, we'll have a report from Sally Bryant on that Canamble meeting. That'll be coming up shortly. Quite an incredible meeting by the sound of things. 24 minutes to one on the New South Wales Country Hour. But to federal politics now, and regional representation in the federal cabinet is set for a shake-up amid changes within the National Party. Victorian Senator Bridget McKenzie this morning beat her colleagues in a ballot to become the party's new deputy leader. Her election comes amid a tense time between the coalition parties after a string of recent political spats, as Brett Worthington reports from Parliament House.
Rayo, it's with great pleasure that I announce that the winner by ballot...
In vintage National Party form, it was far from decisive. Round after round after round, the politicians conducting the ballot for the deputy leadership quickly moved between the party room and a neighbouring office. But in the end, it was the backbencher, Bridget McKenzie, who convinced her colleagues to back her in.
Senator Bridget McKenzie of Victoria. Congratulations, Bridget. Bridget, it's over to you. I'm going to sit down and listen to you.
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you very much, Leader. It's been a great...
The party has been without a deputy since former New South Wales Senator Fiona Nash lost her seat in the Parliament in the dual citizenship saga. In her wake, many jockeyed for the position.
I'd like to say thank you to all my colleagues who competed for the honour, the great privilege of being deputy leader of the National Party. Any one of us could have done that job, and I think that goes to the depth of talent that we have in our team. And the
Bridget McKenzie has been an outspoken Conservative since she first entered the Parliament in 2010. She's used Senate estimates to grill leaders, including the ABC, about regional representation. Just yesterday, she was successful in convincing a Senate committee to refer the embattled marketing and research organisation Australian Wool Innovation to national auditors after a series of scandals. After speaking out against same-sex marriage, she abstained from the final vote in the Senate last week. Today, the new deputy vowed to carry on the legacy of Fiona Nash.
A great friend and a colleague who yesterday's return was ruled out. And I guess, Nashy, love you, can't wait to get on the golf course with you as soon as possible. And I know Fiona has a great future in public service in whatever field she chooses.
But the election of Bridget McKenzie to the party's leadership assures her a seat in cabinet. What portfolio she takes on is yet to be determined. That will be a matter for the Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull. When Fiona Nash lost her seat, her regional development and communication portfolios were shared among cabinet incumbents. As for her priorities, Bridget McKenzie listed an enhanced sugar industry in her home state of Victoria.
Oh, well, I don't define myself by my gender, so I guess I'm just a country Victorian that will also now be looking at issues around sugar.
And what other...
Well, because, you know, we don't have any sugar growers in Victoria, but now as deputy leader, obviously, oh, my...
Going to fix that.
We're going to fix that, right? sorry.
And are there any other particular issues aside from sugar that you're really keen to campaign on as the deputy leader now?
Oh, look, I think it's really important that we have strong economic growth in the regions. And so our decentralisation agenda is something I'm very passionate about and want to see promoted and continued and expanded.
Prior to the citizenship saga, the National Party had 5 seats in cabinet. But Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce, the Nats leader, was unwilling to be drawn if the party would retain the same number in an expected ministerial shake-up.
Mr Joyce, are you guaranteed 5 spots in cabinet for the Nationals?
Well, I mean, all these things will now be discussed. Look, I'm really happy. I'm not going to jump ahead there. I'm really happy that Senator Bridget McKenzie has now got that incredible honour of being the Deputy Leader of the National Party, the second oldest party in the Parliament.
No matter what happens, he and Bridget McKenzie are guaranteed their spots in cabinet. Privately, Liberals hope the Prime Minister reduces the Nats' representation in cabinet after their recent behaviour, including damning public assessments of Malcolm Turnbull. Should the Prime Minister reduce the Nats to 4 seats in cabinet, that puts in doubt the future of 3 Nats currently sitting there. Their Infrastructure Minister Darren Chester from Victoria, Resources and Northern Australia Minister Matt Canavan from Queensland, and Indigenous Affairs Minister Nigel Scullion from the NT.
So who in the cabinet will go, who in the Nats will go out of cabinet?
I'm not going to start discussing
that.
You
must have some idea.
Yeah, well, if I would, I'm not going to put it in a press conference. But
so should Darren Chester and Nigel Scullion and Matt Canavan be nervous right now?
I'm not going to discuss that.
Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce ending Brett Worthington's report. You're listening to The Country Hour, 19 minutes to one. Earlier we were talking about farm safety. We've had a text in on that from Bob at Byron. He says he was proudly slashing on his restored Fergie and he needed water driven up to the dam. He stood up, let his foot off the clutch. He was in gear and he rolled it into the dam. He had to jump off and then glug, glug, the tractor disappeared. And then he had to pay a crane to remove his restored Fergie from the dam and finishes off his text with a reminder, safety first. 18 minutes to one on the New South Wales Country Hour. Well, let's turn our attention now to Australian wool innovation because there's been some discussions in regards to that issue. We won't go to that story. Let's go to the issue in regards to that meeting we were talking about earlier on. We had a text in about the Coonamble meeting because developers of the proposed Northwest Gas Pipeline backed out of yesterday's community meeting in Coonamble, but the meeting went ahead without them. A big crowd from Coonamble, Warren and other communities that were affected by the development were at the bowling club for about 2 hours in a forum to air their concerns. Our reporter Sally Bryant was there and she filed this report.
Coonamble Bowling Club Auditorium was filled to capacity with all sorts of people, young and old, farmers and business people, growers and consumers, all with a single concern about the proposed development. They were there to hear from the Department of Planning and the developers of the project, who put out a late notice saying they would not attend a public meeting, but would instead be meeting with affected landholders on a one-to-one basis. Coonamble farmer Don McKenzie sits on the Community Consultative Committee for the project.
The APA were the ones who didn't stay. Department of Planning were quite happy to. We had a separate meeting after the CCC meeting, but the APA people snuck out the back door and had a police escort waiting for them outside and also to escort them out of Coonamble.
Do you think that that was a bit of overkill?
Extreme overkill, because I extended to them at the meeting this morning an invitation to come along to this meeting this afternoon, and I gave an unconditional guarantee that there would be a completely well-run meeting and there was no danger to them at all.
And what was their response?
They just would not wear that. They just said, no, we're not doing it.
Why do you think that they wouldn't appear? Because they sent a message to the media saying that they wouldn't be here. I think the theory is that they want to meet with farmers one-on-one rather than in a town hall-style meeting.
That's correct. They want that pressure of being able to put pressure on people one-on-one They don't like the pressure being returned on them by having a group of people in front of them.
So what is the community resolved to do now as a result of this meeting today?
The community is resolved to just say no to the whole project. We're wanting to save and protect our water and the food for the future of all Australians.
Archie Kennedy is a farmer from nearby Warren.
I think it's actually been a positive for the APA not turning up today for the meeting that was held here and organised by the fantastic Coonamble community. They're smart, they're on top of these people, and they're starting to play their game, and the APA are starting to realise that they're going to have a real issue trying to get this pipeline through the area. I think they've had to go back to the drawing boards now. This would have been a bad PR exercise if they were here. They would have had a lot of questions to answer, and quite frankly, I don't think they could have answered them. So that was their decision. They weren't here, but I think the Coonamble community here have really got together, as well as other people from other areas. I think it's really been a positive for this group today, and it's only just the starting point for it to go forward in the future.
Now, you've retained legal advice. Are you happy with the advice you're getting from your solicitor, and does it add weight to your belief that, you know, you have a legal position to stand on here?
Oh, definitely. She's a great lawyer in Sydney. She specialised in land access agreements, so I don't think we could be getting a better person down here. And for her to come out here and give her time up for the day, I think it's fantastic. And it just shows her support that she's given us.
Mary Lou Potts is a Sydney-based solicitor who specialises in land access agreements. She's been retained by the Great Artesian Basin Protection Group. She says that farmers who say APA representatives were conducting environmental impact studies have a clear case for trespass.
The provision in the Pipelines Act says an authority to survey will be granted to the holder to enter and to survey the route of the pipeline and associated apparatus and access to that route and take samples. There's no reference to environmental assessment, there's no reference to ecological assessment, cultural heritage assessment. Those express words, that particular language, is necessary.
If landholders who feel that their property has been trespassed on, who feel that they've been offended under law, what steps should they be taking now?
I think they should be writing to APA and saying, those people have trespassed on my land. If they've suffered damage, I think they should be demanding compensation.
And what response, typically in a situation like this, what response would you expect them then to receive from APA?
I think APA will probably ignore them to their peril. I think APA's behaved very badly because you can see the outrage that's in the room. And I think they know they've behaved beyond the scope of their authority to survey. I think they thought they could get away with it. Generally, probably in the past, they would have. And really, without the community neighbourhood watch and the communication that's now available, where people can say the legal advice is and that can run down the 450 kilometres of pipeline within minutes, they would have gotten away with it.
Farmers had come to the meeting prepared with a barrage of questions that they wanted to put to the developers. In their absence, they read them out in front of the community. Landholders like Kate Miller from Warren have questions they want answered, and they also want them answered in a public forum.
You asked to come and collect data specifically for an EIS on our property. My understanding is that's not what you've been granted. An ATS is not to do an EIS. So how can you possibly ask to do that, for starters? That's number one. Number two, I wanted to know where all these cathodic protection beds were going to be. Considering the really large width of heavily flooded plain that you're going through on our property, my understanding is you need to put cathodic protection in because of the salt issues that may arise with the groundwater. That is definitely a case under some of that country. How are you going to even access them when it's under floodwater for up to 5, 6, 7 months at a time?
A whole range of issues were canvassed at this meeting, from points of law to technical issues. It's clear this community not only opposes the pipeline, they're vehemently opposed to any coal seam gas exploration in their region. And they're angry about the way they say they're being treated, and they say they're being misrepresented by the developers.
It was reported that during the confrontation on the 20th of November, APA representatives' tyres were slashed. Now, although we felt intimidated, and we asked our network of friends and families to congregate at Nadu on that day, I can confirm that all parties left without any physical confrontation. We as farmers actually called the police. My husband came across APA in the creek on Ferg's place. We seen that was the reasonable response to make in that situation. But I'd like to know why APA feels they need to make false claims. If they're brazen enough to do so on something that can be easily verified, what length are they going to go to in order to proceed with their proposed pipeline?
That's just some of the voices of dissent from the meeting at the Coonamble Bowling Club yesterday, where the community gathered to voice their concerns and air their grievances about the development of the proposed North West gas pipeline. Well, APA has released a statement. They say that it became apparent this week that social media posts prompting organised disruption to these events for the sole purpose of generating media attention would not allow genuine consultation to take place and could unfairly impact on the normal operations of the meeting venues. Instead, APA will shortly contact directly affected landholders and stakeholder groups with a special interest in the project to arrange forums along the proposed route at agreed venues, times and dates early next year. Department of Planning representatives will also be invited to attend these events and provide feedback. That's their response to the consultation at Coonamble yesterday and their decision to leave the meeting. 9 minutes to one on the New South Wales Country Hour. Now, let's look at some of the texts here. We've had quite a few texts come in on that meeting, and Angus from Coonamble's texted in saying the government have the sheets pulled over their eyes by the big gas companies seeking short-term gains on this issue, all to the detriment of local communities and the agricultural industry as a whole, with the compromise of our groundwater. And another text has come in saying Santos CSG Pilliga project competes directly against rural communities for the underground water. The APA pipeline allows the Pilliga project to be an option which will depressurise and contaminate the Great Artesian Basin. And Mick texted in saying the water, just like the coal seam gas, it's all about the big end of town looking after their mates in both areas. They don't care about the small operators. No wonder what mental issues arise. And Bob at Armidale's texted in saying, good on the Coonamble farmers. They have a great long-term vision for sustainable futures, unlike the water-destroying short-term selfish gas companies. You're listening to The Country Hour, and it's 8 minutes to one.
G'day, I'm Brendan Mansbridge from Yugara. I was born into a farming family. I'm the fifth generation, so I never wanted to do anything else. And I listen to The Country Hour.
Well, the body that wool growers pay for marketing research and improvement of their industry is set to undergo more scrutiny today. ABC Rural has revealed that a Senate committee has referred Australian Wool Innovation to the National Audit Office, as Warwick Long reports.
It's been a big year for the wool industry's peak marketing research and development organisation. This year alone, Australian Wool Innovation has admitted that its chairman watched a focus group from behind a mirror without the participants' consent. That same chair, Wal Merriman, swore at a journalist and told him where to go. It was revealed that CEO of AWI, Stuart McCulloch, billed the organisation $100,000 for a six-week study trip to Stanford University in the United States, and the organisation received a grilling from senators about the levy and taxpayer-funded organisation's conduct this last year.
I'm going to take what is... Just let me finish, Mr Merriman. I see this look of frustration you got. It's nowhere near the frustration I got, sir. So we take...
ABC Rural understands senators from the Rural and Regional Affairs and Transport Committee this morning referred Australian Wool Innovation to the National Audit Office, which can access information not listed in annual reports. Multiple sources have confirmed to the ABC that the Audit Office investigation will assess AWI's corporate governance and transparency surrounding its spending. AWI received almost $75 million from wool growers and taxpayers last year. Leonard Valance, the chair of the Victorian Farmers Federation Livestock Group, supports the move.
That's what you expect from good government, to question industry bodies and utilisation of producers' levy money.
What do you think an investigation like this would find?
Oh, I wouldn't like to speculate on that, but look, it'd be nice if everything came up squeaky clean and everything was appropriate, and time will tell. I mean, the auditors will find it if there is anything to find.
Do you think AWI as an organisation needs to have more transparency and an improvement in its corporate governance?
Look, the VFF's long-standing position on this is that Wool Producers Australia, which is the grower representative body, have oversight of AWI budgets and expenditure of their levy money.
And what do you make of the actions of Australian Wool Innovation over the last few months? It's been an organisation that has been in the headlines for a long time now.
Well, there's sometimes when organisations like AWI, when they're attracting attention that's unproductive, perhaps they should just take a deep breath and say, what are we doing wrong here? And perhaps we take a few initiatives and make the difference, make a change.
So you think they could do that?
I think they could but the way they're behaving at the moment, they're not wanting to change and be more transparent, so now they're being subject to an audit. So that's what's happening.
So this is entirely of their own making, in your view?
I think it is, yeah. They need to sit back and go, well, obviously the levy payers aren't happy and they're putting pressure on through politicians to get some change and get some transparency there in what they're doing. So that's what's happened to them. They've now become subject to this investigation.
And from a levy payer's point of view, and I imagine you represent a few in Victoria, what do they want to know about how the monies that they're paying in levies are being spent?
I think they just want to take comfort in the fact that the money they give to a national body is being used wisely. And that's all they want to know, that they don't want to see money spent on projects or marketing that's probably not the best idea to have.
Leonard Valance from the Victorian Farmers Federation. Australian Wool Innovation said in a statement, and I quote, AWI is aware of the media reports. AWI has not been advised of any inquiry or audit. AWI welcomes any review of its business operations, governance and the benefits we deliver to Australian wool growers. End quote.
Warwick Long with that report. It's 3 minutes to one. Let's go to Wagga Sheep and Lambs. Here's Leanne Dax.
Good afternoon. On the back of torrential rain last week, lambs in all categories became a hot ticket item, with prices surging ahead $10 to $20 in a very good quality yarding of 29,000 lambs and 10,000 sheep. Bidding intensified for heavy shorn lambs, whose price is up to $22 dearer for the shorn portion. Heavy lambs sold from $174 to $254.60. Trade lambs jumped ahead $11 to $12. Light trade $132 to $148. Medium trade $160 to $167. Heavy trade $161 to $178. Averaging $6.70 to $7.05 a kilogram carcass weight. The heavy portion of the lambs $170 to $192. Lightweight store lambs jumped ahead $20, $77 to $115. Store lambs with weight and frame $115 to $128. Reno trade lambs topped at $157.20. And the hog was sold from $126 to $175.20. I'm Leanne Dax for MLA.
To Dubbo Cattle and David Monk.
Good afternoon. The second last sale for the year produced healthy numbers with a yarding of 4,125. It was a pretty good quality yarding with good numbers of young cattle to suit the restockers and feeders, along with a good selection of ground steers and cows. There were also a couple of consignments of plainer quality cattle in from the far west. Young cattle of the trade were 5 cents cheaper, with vealers selling to 3.16 and prime yearlings selling from 2.55 to 2.99. Feeder steers and heavier feeder heifers were 3 to 7 cents cheaper, while the lighter feeder heifers were firm to 2 cents cheaper. Feeder steers sold from 267 to 323, while the feeder heifers sold from 250 to 314. Young steers to the restockers were dearer, selling to 380. Ground steers were 10 cents cheaper, with the prime, medium and heavyweight selling from 250 to 268. Cows were 3 to 6 cents cheaper, with the two scores selling from 168 to 214, while the better 3 and 4 scores sold from 200 to 235, with the prime heavyweights averaging 227. Bulls sold at 266.
This is David Monk in Dubbo for MLA.
Thanks for that, David. You're listening to the New South Wales Country Hour. And a reminder about our Facebook page. Head to Facebook and search for the New South Wales Country Hour, and range of videos there and range of information as well. And hope to have some more about the coal seam gas and the pipeline debate up a little bit later on today. You're listening to the Country Hour. We're heading up to news.